Okay. Welcome back. Will you please join me in the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Okay, our speaker is being recorded tonight with his permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren. And I'd like to introduce John from San Clemente.
Hi, everybody. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. Glad to see you all here tonight. And are there any Al-Anons in the house tonight? All right. Let's round of applause for the Al-Anon members here.
The enemy.
No. I want you to call a backdoor alcoholic. I came here through the back door because I went to Al-Anon first. And I'll tell you that story as we go along. But the kind of I want to tell you. My sobriety date is August 19th, 2000. My home group is the Monday night Drop Your Rock Men's Stag in Capo Beach, and some of my brothers are here tonight. Thank you for not leaving. And my sponsor is Chuck D. from Laguna Niguel. There's a story about the kind of alcoholic that I am, and I heard it once, and it really rang true for me, and so I need to share it with you. It's a story about these three people who were driving out in trying to find this convention they were going to. And there were three people. One was somebody from India, and the other person was from Israel. The other person was an alcoholic. And it was a dark black night. There was no moon, and they took a wrong turn, and they're out in the countryside, and they didn't know where they were going. All they could see was the road in front of them, and all of a sudden, in the distance, they saw this light. And so they said, "Well, let's drive toward the light." So they went to the light, and it turns out that it was this farmhouse. And it was like 12:30 at night. They didn't know where they were, how they were going to get back to where they needed to go. So they knocked on the door, and the farmer answered, and they told him what their problem was. And he says, "Well, you can stay here for the night if you'd like. Problem is, I only have two beds, so one of you is going to have to sleep in the barn." And so the one guy from India says, "Oh, that's okay. You know, I'm used to sleeping out in the wilderness. I'll do that." And so everybody settled in, and it was dark and it was quiet, and all you heard was the crickets chirping, and all of a sudden you hear this, and light goes on. The farmer answers the door, and it's the guy from India, and he says, "Well, what's the matter?" And the guy says, "Well, in my religion, you know, the cow is a sacred animal, and there's a cow in the barn, and I can't sleep near a cow." So the guy from Israel heard this. He says, "It's okay. I'll trade places." So they trade places, and again, it's dark, it's quiet, everybody's kind of settling in. And a few minutes later, you hear this. Farmer gets up, turns on the porch light. This is the guy from Israel, and he says, "You know, I'm not all that real kosher, but there's a pig in there, and I'm not going to sleep with a pig." So finally, the alcoholic says, "All right, I'll go out there." And so, again, you know, it's dark and it's quiet. Crickets are chirping. And all of a sudden you hear this. So the farmer gets up and opens the door, and it's the cow and the pig. So so that's my story. Thanks for letting me share it. No. So I said how I got here is... my son had checked himself out of the university he was attending and checked himself into an alcoholic rehab back in my hometown in Colorado. And I had no idea what the deal was, but I lived next door to this woman who said that she was a sober member of this ANA thing. And she said, you know, and as a matter of fact, she said that she sponsored a lot of people. And I figured, and she was single, you know. I thought, well, this gal's loaded, you know, that's pretty cool. And because I figured she had a lot of money because there were people coming in, women coming to her house all the time, and I figured she was writing checks to them all. And I knew she had to have money because, you know, I had sponsored Little League teams, and I know how expensive, you know, that can be. And It's just a little bit of denial on my part. I mean, I was really out there with it, that, you know, the buses don't run. I want to tell you a little bit more about that, but I want to tell you first, I want to tell you what it was like. I was raised in Denver, Colorado, and I played baseball and I played music. Pretty much, you know, everybody in my neighborhood knew me as Johnny Hartman, the baseball player, and because that's all I did. In the winter time, I'd shovel off the sidewalk and the driveway, and I'd throw a tennis ball against a garage door so I could take ground balls, and I also sang in the choir. I sang in the church choir and whatnot. I was real involved in music, and as time went on, I had an opportunity to play baseball for pay, and. So I did that, but about 5 minutes later, I blew out my shoulder, so my baseball days were over pretty quick, just even before they got started. So I decided I would start playing guitar. I was at this one place. I'd go and I'd have a drink on Friday nights after I'd go to the driving range, and there was this guy playing guitar in this cellar, and he really sucked. I mean, he really sucked. And so I went to the owner, and I walked up to the owner, and I said, "Hey, I understand you're looking for a guitar player." I had no idea. And he said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I am." And so anyway, so I said, "Oh, okay." And so he set up, this was Friday night, and so Monday night they set up for me to come in and play an audition. And I had this buddy of mine who played bass fiddle, stand-up fiddle. And so I said, "Come on, we can maybe get a summer job on weekends." And so anyway, so we went and played for the owners, and it was a pretty neat deal actually, because we played a set for the owners and it was a real dead night typically on Monday nights, but some people started kind of coming down into the cellar where we were playing, and so they asked us to play another set, and we said oh, okay, so we played another set, and then they asked us to play another one. Well, nonetheless, we got the job. It was pretty cool. Because I got to quit my job at the May Company and sing on the weekends. I was making as much money. Of course, you know, being an alcoholic, which I didn't know at the time, I had all that time to myself to go play. And it was wonderful. So I started playing music in around the Denver area, and I got offered a partnership in a nightclub in Cherry Creek. Was a big part of Denver. And in this nightclub, and so I took it, and I got ownership of part of my own club. It was really cool, you know. And then this radio station came over, and then so I ended up with a radio show, and I started doing commercials and, you know, on radio and on TV, and things were going really, really good, you know. And this is you know, the latter part of the '60s and early part of the '70s, and things were good. And I mean, I was really kind of getting, you know, kind of bitching, you know, and kind of man about town type of deal. You know, and the nice thing about, you know, the booze was free. I mean, you know, people were always sending up drinks and drugs for free. and the women were awesome. You know, women that never talked to me before, all of a sudden, because I'm playing guitar and singing, were just astounded by my talent, weren't they? You know, it was pretty cool. And so, it was a lot of fun. So it was a party, and the booze flowed, and things were good. Things were really good. They were a lot of fun, and I started traveling around quite a bit, going to different cities and playing my music. And it was all the same thing. You know, if I go on the road, a guy would come up and shake my thumbs. "Hey, bro." You know, I had long hair. And, "Hey, bro," and they'd have a couple of doobies in his hand, you know, and, of course, the booze again, and all the other stuff that goes along with being a musician on the road back in those days. And those were actually pretty good days back when it was working for me. And it did work for me for a lot of years. And so one day I had my kid brother in my car, and we were driving down this street in the southwest part of Denver, right on the edge of this little suburb called Sheridan. And so, and they were well known for stopping people in their radar traps for 1 mile over the speed limit. And that's how I got stopped. I was doing 46 and a 45, And so they gave me a ticket. So my kid brother was, you know, he was 16, and he was kind of like this, oh my gosh, you know. And I said, it's okay, just put it in the glove box, and I forgot about it. And so sometime later, there was a knock at my front door. And it was a policeman. And I went, what the hell is a policeman doing at my front door? And so I said, can I help you? And he asked if I was, are you John? I said, yeah, I am. And so he had this bench warrant thing. And I said, what's this for? And he says, well, it was a failure. You didn't appear for the ticket. And I frankly didn't remember it until a little bit later. And he said, so we need you to come down. We need you to come with me. And somehow I talked him out of it. I think I said something. I was busy. And I mean, you know, remember, I'm a ditching guy here, you know, so I was busy. And so I said, I'll come back. I'll come over a little bit later. And so that afternoon I showed up and, oh, by the way, my roommate was on the Denver Police Force. And that's a whole different story. But so I called him in the afternoon and told him what the deal was. He says, I'll come get you and we'll do the bail. So he showed up in uniform with a lieutenant in uniform. I guess they had this little rift going between the Denver Police Force and this little city. So they came and bailed me out. And so I had to go to court that night to answer my ticket. So what happened then was, you know, we're all sitting there and they called my name, and so I went up and so they, you know, I had to pay a check, give them a check because I was guilty as charged. And so I wrote a check out and I wrote it out to the pigs. And I mean, remember, you know, I'm a bitching guy here, and I've got a radio show and all that stuff. You know, I'm a bitching dude. And so I was walking out of the court, and so the judge called me back, and he said that he had my check in his hand, and he said you wrote the check out incorrectly. When he should have thrown my butt in jail for contempt, because I actually was totally in contempt of court, but I was so full of myself that I didn't think anything of it. So I just wrote out another check the way he asked me to write it out. But that wasn't good enough, you know. I had to say more, and so I said, Your Honor, I need a word. I said, I just want you all to know that, you know, I've got a radio show on KHOW. And tonight we're gonna be talking about this whole situation, and you all are gonna be the star of my show. So please tune us in, you know. And he still should have thrown, and he didn't. So I walked out of there, and I thought I was pretty hot stuff, you know. Got away with it one more time. Brings to mind that 12th promise, you know, that God is doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I had a lot of contempt at the time. I had a lot of contempt for any kind of authoritarian figure. But that was just the way I did things. I was kind of like a bull in the china closet, you know. Don't get in my way. It's my way. It's my club. It's my gig. You do it my way, and that's just the way it was. My name's on the marquee out there, so you'll do it my way. And again, at the time that worked. So. And by the way, so then I had divorced my wife. We had a little boy, and I was playing the role of Mr. Bachelor, and thinking I was pretty hot stuff. And all the while we're doing all the booze is flowing and the parties are happening. It's still working for me. I'm still having a good time with it. So then I had an opportunity to come to California, and I had always wanted to live in California. I was actually born in Los Angeles, but had an opportunity to move to California. I had a financial backer who was going to finance my music career, and so I moved out here, and had another wife in the waiting. I just I used to have, you know, a lot, but anyway. I used to say that I'd go from woman to woman and in marriage to marriage, and I would tell my friends, well, at least I'm not afraid of commitment. And I really believe that, you know. And I would get that deer in the headlights look, but I really actually believe my own lies to myself. But nonetheless, I moved to California and lived in San Diego, and I was playing all the clubs in San Diego and the hotels and the restaurants on Harbor Island down there. And so one night I was playing at the boathouse on Harbor Island, and it was really a great night. I mean, it was really an energy filled night, and the audience was clicking, you know, So I was taking requests, and I said, gosh, you know, if you have a request, write it down on the back of a $5 or $10 bill and send it up, write it for less and that sort of thing, and singing songs, and everybody's, you know, doing this. And I said, well, I got a request for this one song, so that's a one drink request. And so somebody sent up a tequila shooter with it. And, with the lime and the salt rim and all that sort of thing. And so I did that up real big. I mean, I really played it to the hilt, and so I licked my hand and really did that up big time, you know, and the girls were squealing, you know, and I poured the salt and licked it and did the lemon and threw it down and sang the song. I said, well, that was so good. I'd do that song again for another one. Well, no sooner had I done that, another one showed up, and then another one showed up, and they kept showing up. And then the shooters, instead of shot glasses, started showing up in the full rock glasses, and I was throwing those down. And they told me it was 13. I don't remember. I didn't count them. But at the end of the night, I was trying to finish the last song at the end of the night. And I was so drunk that I couldn't get out of the first verse. I couldn't remember anything but the first verse. Now, I never said foul language on stage, okay? But I always said stuff to make you think the foul word or the foul thought. And I just thought that was better. So, but I couldn't, I was so frustrated, I just put my guitar down and I said, oh, F it, you know? And I went and sat down, and the crowd roared and everybody applauded and standing and all that. And I mean, and I was delirious. I was so loaded I couldn't see straight. And there were some friends of mine that were there, because I knew I couldn't drive. I mean, I did know that I couldn't. I was too drunk to drive. And so, you know, you always have, when you're a singer and guitar player, you always have friends that are willing to help in many ways. And so this one couple was there, and they were friends of mine. As a matter of fact, they came to all my gigs because they were nudists, and they were always inviting me to join them at their club. and I would never do that. You know, that's just not something I wanted to do, but they were there. And so I said, well, I wonder if you could, you know, would you drive me home? I'm too drunk to drive. And so they did. And the last thing I remember, I'm sitting in the middle of the front seat of my car, and I've got my arms out around both of them, and my friend Larry was driving, and I turned to him, I'm telling him what a great friend he was, and just going on and on. In the meantime, I've got my hand down his wife's sundress, and that's the very last thing I remember. And so the next morning I came to. I came to actually in my bed. And I was buck naked, and I don't remember the ride home. I don't remember getting there. I don't remember anything about it. And but I woke up, and I was still very, very drunk. I didn't wait. I came to. And later on, I asked him, you know, what happened, and they just giggled. You know, they were going to say anything. And that was a consistent behavior that I had. I would come to in many different places, not knowing how I got there. You know, who were you? Where are my clothes? Where's my car? Any of that stuff. So the next morning I woke up after I got out of bed. As I said, I was still very, very drunk. And I was playing a couple of different gigs in San Diego. I was playing this one hotel. I played an afternoon cocktail hour gig, and part of the pay on that deal was I get a free meal every day at the hotel. So I figured if I just go down to the hotel and have breakfast, then you know I'd start to feel better. Well, so I went down to the hotel and went to the coffee shop, and I'm sitting at the counter, and I told you I had played baseball before, and so in San Diego, the Dodgers were in town to play the Padres, and they were staying at this hotel. Well, so and they were all in the coffee shop eating. You know, there was Baker, there was Lopes, Garvey, and Sake, and all those guys. You know, and sitting at the counter next to me was Vin Scully. Now, for those of you that are baseball fans, know that Vin Scully is a Hall of Fame announcer, and he's a truly an icon in the announcing industry. And he was sitting right next to me at the counter, and I couldn't even look at him. And looking back, that was the first experience that I recognized in chapter 3, where we talked about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And that was my first real experience with that, because here's a man I could have really had wonderful conversation with. And I think about that every time I hear him announcing a Dodgers game today. And I hung my head. I hung my head. I hadn't ever been that low before. And I didn't realize that the booze was starting to not work for me. And I decided at the time, I'm done with this. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm done drinking. And so I quit drinking. So about 2 weeks later, I'm playing another place, and I broke my promise to myself, of course, and did the same thing, and came to someplace else. And that was a pattern that I would follow for many years. And I thought it was still working for me, you know, but I was going through gigs, I was going through musicians, I was going through girlfriends, I was going through wives, but I was always working. I was always a working musician. I didn't realize how really demoralized my life had become. I talked about a while ago that I have a son. And I left him at home in Colorado when he was about a year old to move out to California. So my mother would bring him out to visit in the summertime, or I would go back to Colorado, play a gig, and visit my son. Well, by now, my son is going to a university. And I had left the music business by now, and I was not in the music business. I was working in this office, and I'd been drinking some more again, and my wife had kicked me out of the house, and so I was sleeping on the floor of the office where I was working, and that's where I stayed. And as long as I didn't make any noise, my boss said, okay, you can stay here, and so I rolled up my sleeping bag and slept on the floor in the office. So my son was going to college, He said, listen, you know, there was a father-son thing at the university. He says, Dad, I'd like you to come out, and we're having this function and whatnot. And I said, sure, I'll be glad to come out. And I promised to contribute some stuff to the event. Mind you, I'm sleeping on the floor of the office, and I didn't have a dime to my name. And there was no way I could go to the Midwest, jump a plane to go to the Midwest. And so I left him there, and I left him high and dry. And I broke another promise to him, and that's the kind of thing that I used to do when I drank. I would break promises. I would take from you, and I would use you for whatever I could use you for, as long as I could get through my day. So that was my third divorce. On December the 5th of 1989. I've been split up from my third wife, and I had gotten a call from my son's mother back home in Colorado, and said that he checked himself out of the university that he was attending and checked himself into an alcohol rehab. And she just wanted to let me know that. And so that woman that lived next door to me I was telling you about, I went next door to her because I figured she knew a lot about this stuff because it said something about alcoholism. Again, I still had no clue. And I said, well, I told her what happened, and I didn't know. I said, you know, gosh, you know, maybe you could help me. Maybe there's some kind of a counseling thing that I can go to, because I was going to, this was December the 5th, and I was going to be flying back home to Denver for Christmas with my family and seeing my son, right? Well, just about then, she says, no, just go to Al-Anon. I said, Al-Anon? What's an Al-Anon? She says, look it up in the white pages. So that was December the 5th of 1989. And so that's when I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And it was pretty cool because, you know, the people were very nice. They're, you know, I didn't know what to expect. But they were telling stories about their alcoholic, you know, like they owned one. But they were telling stories about the alcoholic in their life. And they were talking about the stuff that I did. But I thought, well, I'm no alcoholic, you know, but they're talking about stuff that I did. But they encouraged me to keep coming back. And so I did keep coming back, you know, and I started getting really involved, you know, because, well, first of all, I didn't have any money. And secondly, it was better than what was on TV. And so, you know, it was new people to see and to meet and new stories to hear. And so I was going to meetings all the time. And so finally, I met a sponsor. And he didn't know it yet, but anyway. See, I had auditioned, because I was used to auditioning musicians, you know, to play on my gigs. But so I called two or three guys, and I listened to what they had to say in the meetings, and so I'd ask them questions on the phone. So there's this old guy named Tim, and so Tim liked to play golf, and I played a little golf and whatnot. And so I said, so you know, if you could play golf sometime, you got room, I'd love to come join you. So we went out and played golf one time. And it was right about then I decided I needed to ask him to be my sponsor. I mean, I was really thinking about it. So we're up on the golf course playing. It was on the fourth hole at San Clemente Municipal. And I went to him and I said, so would you consider, if you're not too busy, would you think about maybe if you could, you know, just a little at a time, would you be my sponsor? And he turned to me and says, well, I'd be honored. And I was really, really thrown for a loop, you know. I didn't know at the time what to do. I didn't know if there would be some kind of ring exchange or something like that. You know, it was, I had no clue. But what we did, we started working steps. And I got real close to the guy. And now this guy was a straight Al-Anon. And we would go different places to play golf. And he got me real involved in service to the program. And this is not an Al-Anon meeting, by the way. I'm telling you how I got here. I spoke at a lot of meetings, was on service board and all that sort of thing, you know, and happy to do it, you know. And I was speaking at the Orange County Convention to the Al-Anons. And you know, one thing I did when I first got into Al-Anon is I was going to open AA meetings. And what was really cool is I really liked what you alcoholics were talking about. I liked your stories. You know, and I thought, God, it'd just be fun to be an alcoholic. You guys have so much fun, you know, because in my meetings we're all kind of sullen, you know, and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, I was making friends with a lot of the alcoholics. And so one of my friends said to me one time, says, well, John, we're saving you a seat here. And I said, oh, no, I'm not an alcoholic. I just like your stories. And I was speaking at this convention, and I was supposed to be speaking on humor, and so I was telling a few of my humorous stories, and I thought they were getting pretty funny, and my alcoholic friends in the crowd were laughing and slapping their heads. The Al-Anons were starting to cross their arms, you know, and kind of leaning back, you know, one eyebrow up, and so after about 20 minutes, you know, I said, well, that's all I got. Thank you so much for letting me, and I was out of there. And so I told Pat, I said, come on, let's go up to the room. And I told her, I says, you know, I feel like the biggest fraud in the world. I said, I don't have anything to give. I said, I have nothing to, I don't want anything I've got. Why would anybody else? And so I decided I was gonna quit sharing in meetings, gonna quit speaking in meetings, I was gonna quit doing everything until I figured out what the hell was going on with me. And so that was in March, and in the first part of August, Pat and I went to Montreal on a trip in my business, and I earned this trip with the company. And we came back from the trip to Montreal, and it was a lot of fun. And our next door neighbors threw a party, a dinner for us. And so at this dinner, oh, by the way, back in Colorado, I used to have a radio show to boot. I don't know if I told you that or not. Oh, I did. Anyway, so there was this person who had, see, it's still there, it's still not all firing, are they? So at this party, there was this woman there who had a radio show in the Inland Empire. So we were talking shop and we were drinking wine, you know. And so the next morning I came to, and, you know, and my head was just going like this. And I told Pat, I said, well, you know, I wasn't really all that impressed with that woman. And she said, really? I said, what are you talking about? She says, well, you wouldn't know it by what you were doing. I said, and I thought, well, what did I do? You know, and I thought I'd really done something terrible. And she says, oh, no. She says, but you were on stage. You were the entertainment for the night. And I didn't remember what I had done, what I'd said. I did not remember having dinner. She says, I had a full dinner. I remember nothing of it. By this time, I'd had 11 years in the program of Al-Anon. And then it suddenly dawned on me, I'm a blackout drinker. And so it was right then and there. I found an AA meeting to attend. And so I went to the South Coast Hospital at the time, and they had a meeting on a Sunday morning. And I went over there, and of course, didn't want to get too involved at first, so I raised my hand as a visitor. But after a couple of weeks, we went around, you know, and I finally raised my hand and said, John Alcoholic. And I went, what the heck did I just say? But you know, it felt so right. It felt right. It was the cog that was missing in the wheel for me. I had come home. I had come home to a place that I really needed to be, that I'd never been before. And that was Alcoholics Anonymous. It was probably the best moment in my life to realize that I was an alcoholic and that I wanted to get sober. And that date was August 19th of 2000. You know, and I haven't had a real desire to go out and drink ever since. I've been clean and sober ever since that day. So I haven't gone back out yet. And hopefully, by the grace of God, I won't. But I do suffer from that disease of more, you know. If there's food on the plate, I want more. If there's dessert, I want more. If I'm playing golf, let's play a little more. You know, the things that I do, I like to do more. Today things are really a lot different. I mean, my life is so much better. You know, the landlord is not banging on my door telling me to get the hell out of his house. The repo guy isn't coming looking for my car, because I went through all that, and I had to give up cars, and today I live in this beautiful city of San Clemente, you know, and I have a mortgage that's paid on time. And I have a wife that I've been faithful to. And, I mean, that's total contrary action for me. Totally contrary action for me. Because that's not who I used to be. And, you know, I met her in Al-Anon. Reminds me of a story I heard at an AA speaker meeting early on. And this one speaker was talking about, he says, are you alkies out there? He says, you know, there's, you know, the boy meets girl on AA campus. You know, if you want to get married, don't marry another alcoholic. Marry an Al-Anon. That way there's two people thinking about you, you know. And no offense, honey. And my wife is here with me tonight, and I'm so grateful. You know, I never thought I would be the kind of person that could be with one woman in a committed basis for hopefully the rest of my life. I told her, as a matter of fact, when we got married in Maui, I told her, I said, you know, we're in this for the long haul. If you ever leave me, I'm coming with you. I told her that. So she kind of did a double take, but so far it's worked out well. And she still gives me that smile that You know that smell you get when you have gas? That. But but so we do get to travel now and then, and it's really a lot of fun because she's a tremendous traveling companion, and I love to go with my bride wherever we go. And one of the trips that I had was to Maui again for my business, and I was out playing golf with a couple of my colleagues, and you know, those guys are out there, and I was in AA, and it was about 10 years ago. And we're out on the golf course, and I love the game of golf, and I revere the game of golf, and I love it for all the things that a golf stands for. And they were out there just tearing up the course and cutting up, and it was really getting under my skin. And they're really pissing me off, you know. And I walked up, I said, "You don't do that shit. Stop that crap." You know, and I felt myself kind of getting out of whack here. You know, I'm starting to open my eyes and starting to kind of look at them like this, you know. And we finally got through the round, and I'm boiling, you know. And Pat picked me up from the course, and I said, "I'm so," and I was really angry, and I was just shaking. And we're driving up this road and to our condo, and Pat says, "Oh, honey, there's a civil defense sign, the AA sign, right?" And so I made a very, very illegal U-turn. I don't know if you've driven in the islands much, but they don't like that much, especially Halley's. But I did this big, big illegal U-turn. I went, and they were the Lahaina Alano Club was having a 4th of July meeting down at the beach. So I pulled in there. I don't even remember opening the door for her or anything. I was running up to somebody. I remember running up to her and saying, "My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic, and I need a meeting bad." And so she says, "Oh, yeah, you're welcome. Come on, we're having a big party, and we've got food here. We're going to have some music. Come on down." And you know, just the air kind of went out right then and there, you know. And it was so cool because we had lunch. We had some really neat music, met some neat people, and then they had a meeting on the beach, and we shared. And so they even let my wife share. And she says, "Well, how about you?" And I said, "Oh, no, I'm an Al-Anon." She said, "Okay, you can share too." And so she shared. It was so cool. It was really a beautiful, you know, the family in Hawaii is called the Ohana, and I've become very close to a lot of those people over there from my trips, and I have friends over there that are just beautiful people, and you know, it is so wonderful to travel and to know that wherever I go, I can find an AA meeting wherever I go. Another trip was to the Big Island, and I just real quickly I want to tell you that story, but. We were there. It was around Thanksgiving time. It was the week before, and some stuff was going on in my life, and that, you know, that thing started happening in my head. You know, those voices were starting to talk, and my skin was starting to crawl, and I knew I had to find a meeting. So when I got there, the next morning I woke up. It was very early their time because you know we're on daylight savings time, so it was 3 hours difference. So I slept in till 4 a.m. their time. And so I got up and I was having a cup of coffee. It was about 7 o'clock finally, and I saw these people. It was next. There was this churchyard next to the condo we had, and there was a group of people out there, and it looked like the church group. You know, they were having a meeting outside, and so I was watching them. You know, I was watching them have their meeting, and at the end, you know. Boy, things started to look kind of familiar, and at the end, they all kind of grabbed hands like this, and I saw him doing this, you know. I said, "Wait a minute." So I went around, and I walked up to this woman. One woman, I said, "What kind of group you got here?" She says, "Oh, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet here every morning at 7 a.m. I said, "I'll see you tomorrow morning." And I went there, and they saved my bacon, because I was able to go there and share with them the fact that I was having some real problems, and I was this close to going back out, and it was real serious, and I was really afraid I was going to drink, and they just kind of took me in their arms and welcomed me, and so I went. I was able to spend the week there with them, and then on Thursday they said, "Well, so come on up country with us. We're going to have a big Ohana Thanksgiving up here with everybody in AA." So I got to go up there and spend Thanksgiving with my brothers and sisters in AA. And you know what's really interesting is when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, you really aren't the kind of people that I would used to hang with, I thought. You know, I thought, oh, no, not the kind of people. But you know what? The longer I stay here in this program and the more I do in this program, the more I get to know you, you know, I've come to realize a long time ago now that you know, you really are my brothers and sisters. Because you're the only ones that really know what's going on inside of me. My family doesn't know what's going on inside, but they don't know, well, why did John snap at that girl? What was with John that? You guys know that. You've been there. You know, and I can come here and I can share that with you. I can share that with a sponsor. I can share that with a guy that I sponsor. You know, it's a special bond that I have with all of you. And you know, I don't know some of your names. I only know your first names, most of you. You know, but I know you and you know me better than my own family. That is so special to me. One of the other trips, just as I'm starting to wind down here, one of the other trips we took was to Ireland. And it was such a great trip. We went to Ireland and we were going over there for 2 weeks. And so we get there and so we rent our car, you know, it's got a van and the steering wheel's on the other side of on the right side of the vehicle and they drive on the left side of the road. And so I said, well, you know, I'm a pretty good driver, I think, so I can handle this. So we're on the west side of Ireland, and so we checked into our bed and breakfast, and so we're going down these really thin roads, you know, two lane highways and big bushes on the hedges on the side of the road. And so I'm kind of figuring out, okay, well, I can handle this. And so just about then over the hill, all I see is windshield. It was this big tour bus come over and it rocked us, you know, and I could feel the van hitting against the hedge. And I thought, oh boy, 2 weeks here, I'm not going to make it. I really didn't think I was going to make it. So, but for about a week, we traveled on and traveled along through around Ireland. And we got to a town called Killarney. And by then, I was really biting my nails. And so I figured I needed to find a meeting somewhere in Killarney, and I was bound and determined to find one. Well, I found one, and I had to get to a telephone. Where'd I find a telephone? In a pub. So I found a telephone. I found Alcoholics Anonymous. And so it was in this big, beautiful old church. And I had to climb up three stairs outside in a staircase on the outside of the building, three stories up to this door. And so I go in the door. And so I walk in and I reach out my hand to shake the first man's hand that I saw, right? And so instead of shaking my hand, he handed me a coffee pot and he says, "Here, get some water." And I knew I was home. And it was really wonderful because they're just so delightful. And the guy that led the meeting, you know, he had one of the fingers that was, you know, cut up to here, and the only tooth in his head was black, and he smoked a pipe, and it was cool because at the end of their meeting, they say not only the Serenity Prayer but the Our Father, but they say it really fast, and then they say, "Keep coming back, works." You know, I'm looking around, but they had all the same slogans and the signs up and the steps and traditions up on the wall, just like we have here. So if you're ever someplace, you know, and you're kind of out there, just know that Alcoholics Anonymous is out there for you. I want to tell you a real quick story about my son. When I got into Al-Anon, after I'd been in Al-Anon a while, my son decided to break off all contact with me. And he refused to have contact with me, any contact whatsoever. And for 2 years, I didn't hear from him. So after I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous a couple years, he went out. And he got drunk. And we'd made amends to him and whatnot. We'd gotten close again, so he called me and he told me that he went out, and he said, "But you knew I was going out, didn't you?" I said, "Yeah." And he says, "And you didn't tell me?" I said, "Nope." And he said, he thanked me, and I said, "Well, did you call your sponsor?" And he says, "No, I wanted to call you first." And so I told him, "You be sure to call your sponsor." But It's such a neat thing. You know, I have a son that's not only my son in life, but he's also my brother in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so when we talk, sometimes I'll call him at work and he calls me, you know, from the car going home. He lives in another state. And we have a meeting, just the two of us, a father-son meeting. It's just the best. It's just the best. So I just want you to know that, you know, I never slept in the bushes yet. I haven't been in a prison yet. I haven't done a lot of the yets. But I have that disease of more, and I know that I'm one drink away from doing that. And that's not a fun place to be. And I am so grateful to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard a story that an alcoholic speaker was once speaking, and I'd like to share that with you in my closing tonight. And he was saying that it was a story about a young journalist who was a cub reporter for the New York Times, and he was in India, and he came upon Gandhi. And he met him, and he was going to interview Gandhi. It was a tremendous thing. And he said, "So I see that you, when you greet one another in your culture, you kind of put your hands together in a prayer-like thing, and you bow your heads, and you say this word, Namaste." And he says, what does that mean?" And so Gandhi looked at me, says, "I'll have to get back to you. I have to talk to you later about that, what it is." So the cub reporter thought he got blown off. But a couple years later, Gandhi was in New York City, and so this reporter went up to him and he says, "I don't know if you remember me or not, but I met you in India." And Gandhi interrupted him. He says, "Yes, I do remember you. You asked me the meaning of Namaste." And he said, "And the meaning came to me in a meditation so that I could tell you in your language. And Namaste means that I honor that place inside of you of light. I honor that place inside of you of love. And I honor that place inside of you where the entire universe resides. And I honor that place that when you are in that place inside of you, and I am in that place inside of me, there is but one of us. And that's what I feel about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are one. Thank you for my sobriety, and thank you for letting me share."